In the radio studios, the technicians, the entertainers, the commentators, the administrative personnel daily unite their efforts in the creation of programs to please and entertain a vast radio public.
We awaken to it in the morning. We set our clocks by it. We dress according to the weather reports. We listen to radio for news, for entertainment. It keeps us informed every minute of every day. That's radio for you, close to every member of the family. From its very birth, radio has been a public servant. It will continue its dedicated service throughout the years to come.
You're tuned to CJ 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome, this is Manga Carta Pro Bono Radio. You're sitting with Charles Campbell and my co-host
Nicholas Harris.
And we are two Windsor Law students, which is excited to take you on a wonderful legal journey today.
Thank you for that, Charles. Just a reminder, you are listening to CJAM 99.1, Windsor, Detroit. Now, when you think of lawyers and law students, you often think of the high prices that come with their services. Many people can't afford these essential services, whether it be helping them make a will, help them get out of a bad legal situation, and many more scenarios. This leads to what we call access to justice issues, where segments of our population suffer because they can't get the necessary legal representation. Pro Bono Students Canada is an organization consisting of many Canadian law schools and hundreds of Canadian law students as they interface with their community and help vulnerable populations obtain the legal services that they need. Today we'll be looking at an example of that, as we'll be interviewing two volunteers from the Windsor Youth Intake Project. Before that, we'd like to talk about some important legal news affecting both the country and the Windsor area.
Well, Nick, today let's just focus on the Windsor area because the country is a bit expansive. But the biggest thing today, All right, so in the Windsor area, downtown Windsor, there is a well-known residence space called the Westcourt Place. And recently, it's been brought to CTV News and various news outlets' attention that there's a class action developing from a law firm, Strasburg, Sasso, and Suits, LLP, for residents that are being left homeless because of a fire that happened in the parking garage of their building. So, the biggest takeaway from this is that, what is a class action? And the realities of what comes with the class action really stands out to me, is that a class action basically is a case that many individuals in the community with a similar legal issue join together to bring forth a similar case, and they launch that case against one particular defendant. And in this case, this would be Westcourt Place. And now what's interesting about that is that without the opportunity to bring forth a class action, and as my colleague Nick was representing earlier about access to justice issues, class actions allow for these parties and individuals to bring forth a case that they would not have the finances to bring forth on their own. And, you know, so what do you take away from class actions? And should we raise more class actions to increase access to justice? Or is it more difficult in your opinion, Nick?
I think at the face value, class actions are a good thing. So oftentimes you have people who have been, they feel they've been wronged by an entity that has much more resources than they possess. So as a result, doing a class action is a good communal way to pull together resources and get justice. Another interesting is that a lot of the time is that when lawyers take these cases, the clients don't have to pay anything unless if the lawyer wins. This is what we call a fees on a contingency basis. So the lawyer and clients agree that if the case is successful, the lawyer will take like 30% of the winnings, and if they lose, the client does not have to pay any fee. So this is definitely a good avenue for access to justice aspects. And in fact, you can tell that it's very good because in countries like the United States, and of course to a lot of degree here too, companies try to prevent you from going into class actions by making you sign arbitration agreements that force you into going in front of an arbiter instead of court and making it impossible for you to do a class action.
Interesting. So getting some interesting insight. So in this case, what's unique about this is that the residents here were displaced from their home. After the fire, there was no access and no timeline that was given to them. This is an article from up till last night. So they've been displaced since about Tuesday. And, you know, one of the residents has been noted as saying that they weren't able to go in and retrieve anything except for two pairs of pants for his spouse and himself. And you saw a lot of residents leaving in the news video and getting on the bus and, you know, trying to find places to stay. Now, what also happens in a class action, you got to think about is what happens with, where do those people's fees for hotel stay or Airbnb stay, or if they don't have relatives in the city, how is that all taken care of? That all comes as a part of the damages assessment that comes with, that's provided to these individuals after a class action is successfully launched and if they're successful. And what's also interesting in this case is how do you, and I guess I can pass this to you, Nick, as well, how much of an emphasis should individuals with minimal access to legal rights, so again, an access to justice issue, how much of an emphasis should be placed on them to have the knowledge of class actions? Because a lot of times class actions are being launched and people don't know about it. So should there be more of a positive emphasis on giving people access to these things? And also, if you're an individual that lives in this residence and doesn't know this is going on, there is a hyperlink on CTV News website and other websites. If you go to your local library, and you'll see where you can be a part of this class action if you're interested. But, you know, aside from that, focusing more on the legal aspects of it, what are some of the things that you would say that a resident or an individual Canadian should be mindful of? And is a class action something that the citizen should know is happening, or should there be more of a focus of bringing that awareness to the individual?
Thank you for that information, Charles. On to the topic of emphasizing the existence of a class action, it depends on what the firm decides to do. So oftentimes they'll publish ads in the newspaper if they're a bigger firm, or if the class action is wide-ranging, like against a corporation, they'll publish in multiple newspapers, TV stations will pick up the news of the suit. So there is already a whole lot that is going on, and I don't have enough inside knowledge to determine whether or not how much more should be done. I think a very prudent aspect that law firms should pursue is advertising on social media like Facebook, Instagram, and other avenues, because especially with the younger generation, like millennials, X, and of course Generation Z, is that a consumption of traditional media such as newspapers is really declining. So law firms definitely need to pursue that trend to ensure that everyone who is affected can knows about the class action. What is your take on this?
Thank you, Nicholas. That's a very solid take. I think it's similar. I think it kind of gets tricky to put more of an emphasis on the firms to do that because, you know, how would they have knowledge of potential plaintiffs? And also, you got to give, not every plaintiff is going to be interested in being a part of the class action, you know. So
a lot of people just don't want to be bothered.
Yeah, a lot of people don't want to be bothered. And a lot of people, when they think of the law, they automatically, like you started off earlier today, they start off by thinking, oh boy, here comes major legal fees, right? So, you know, I guess, you know, dispelling a misnomer in the community is what not only PBSC is trying to do in Pro Bono Students Canada, but it's something that I guess needs to be more of a positive obligation on the legal community as a whole to incubate more access to justice opportunities to protect citizen rights. If you have any other, you have any more thoughts on this topic, or do you want to go into our next news article? I have another one that's very interesting.
I think we're good to move on. I hope the situation is resolved quickly because that would. That would not be good at all to be evicted from your home due to a fire.
Of course. Our thoughts and prayers are with those individuals that have been evicted. And we really hope there's a speedy resolution. The last update that I saw was potentially between tomorrow and Sunday, but this is totally an article that's probably outdated by the time this publication comes out. The next topic that we'll be looking at is vaping. And the article that I found is the BC government moves to tax and restrict vaping products to protect youth. And I believe this article is a little more expansive than what we were originally going to look at, which was speaking about Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, because in this case, it asks us as consumers, is there an explicit obligation to have a positive outlook on the health of citizens? You know, and for me, I'm wondering if, you know, is it in the law's purview to create, you know, legislation and various things that individuals should have the freedom to enjoy without restriction, even if it comes at an alarming death toll. And, you know, I wonder if that's something, it's a similar incident that happened with smoking cigarettes. When cigarettes first came out, the onus Health Canada placed on the Health Canada placed on the cigarette companies in terms of minimizing their ability to promote and all of these things. It was done, but not so much that it doesn't restrict the individual's ability to purchase these goods, not as deleteriously. But in this instance, what is being introduced in British Columbia is that there's a tax and a restriction for vaping products to protect youth. So I guess my question in this case, you know, to you, Nicholas, would be, would you say that there is more of a positive right, which means, and you can explain to the listeners what positive right is when I pass you the question, there's more of an emphasis of a positive right to make sure that individuals' lives and well-being is protected when it comes to, you know, enjoying leisure activities that may have a harmful effect? Or is that restriction not only relegated to specific individuals, but it's more so to various people from different groups? So because vaping is predominantly a youth-oriented activity, is that why there should be an elevated positive right by the government to restrict its use? And that's a very long question. I'm sorry about that.
No problem. I think what's in my opinion, because the government, of course, does have an obligation to in a way restrict people's rights with when it comes to certain things. This is a very Canadian, very Canadian view of it. When it comes to public safety, too, the government does have to step in. And what the difference is between this and smoking is that there's a lot of media coverage of deaths of people very young because they were using marijuana and other black market compounds in the vape, and that caused them to overdose and die. So the situation is different because the government, the regulations you were talking about is just smoking in general. People aren't, as we know, are dying of black market cigarettes. So when we talk about positive rights, that's of course the freedom not to be subjected to government action or the wills of another group. And of course, the listeners may or may not know, Section 1 of the Canadian Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms allows the government to curtail many of the rights they give us, as long as it's reasonable and in the public good. Too, and of course, whether or not there's a whole bunch of case law and jurisprudence that determines what is a good reason to curtail rights and what's the best way of doing that. So I think in this case, it's good. I think the government is going about it in a decent way. It's no different than the way they tax tobacco or the way they plan to tax marijuana, too. So
that's a great answer, Nicholas. And I think what also takes this a step further is British Columbia, and one of the greater issues in the Western provinces. Well, in Canada in general, there's an overwhelming opioid crisis in terms of the use of drugs. But in Western Canada, as a previous student of a Western Canadian law school, that was something that was a highly contested issue. A lot of my colleagues had loved ones that were battling with drug and alcohol addiction, but primarily, addictions to real hard drugs like, crack, cocaine, methamphetamines, and beyond. And one of the big excerpts from this article that really stood out to me and probably provides a bit more context is that, the health minister, Adrian Dix, made a comment and said, in a short number of years, vaping has shifted from being a smoking cessation tool for adults to an addiction traps for our youth. And if that's the case, is there more of a positive right now to mitigate those addiction traps that's being created? As you can in British Columbia, when they have safe spaces for people that have illegal drugs to take them, and there's a nurse on site. That's highly contested in Canada because a lot of people
in Windsor too.
But this only reason why I mentioned Western Canada is because of the article. But yeah, in Canada as a whole, actually, they have these spaces. And what's crazy about it is that a lot of people are like, are we encouraging people to take these drugs, not realizing what comes with addiction? A lot of people can't help themselves, but for taking it in safe spaces where there's a nurse on hand, then these people are more attuned to finding themselves in positions where their lives are at risk. So balancing those comparative objectives with, in terms of the governmental duty, like you were speaking of, Nicholas, is a very, very tricky and tall order for the government.
Definitely. Of course, there's always the view that the government kind of probably enjoys doing this too.
It's good, and it provides a space for more taxation, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like as we see with alcohol, tobacco, another aspects of it's another source of revenue. Do you think that the vaping epidemic is being overblown by the media? It's a new product. When new products that come out like this, there's often sometimes what people say. Purport to be hysteria. Do you think that's the case here?
That's a great question, Nicholas. I believe that it could be in some cases, and it may not be in others. And I know that's a very law student lawyer answer, but I only say that because there is more of a positive obligation, in my opinion, for the government to advocate for the interests of their youth when they see an issue that can have the potential to develop based off of experiences in the past. And this article really typifies the idea that, there is an issue that's starting to breed where individuals are taking more and more of these vaping products. More and more, it's becoming a gateway tool for individuals that have never smoked a cigarette in their life to try vaping. And eventually, when it becomes useless or they're not as interested, they shuffle it between vaping and cigarettes, and then even vaping itself carries its own issues for the health risk of these individuals, especially how it's being marketed. So
marketed as being much better than cigarettes, which is true, but people, as a result, right. people are smoking way more of it.
Exactly, exactly. Because you got to think about it. Like, if someone is addicted to nicotine and smoking cigarettes and they smoke a pack plus a day, they're going to create that same safe space of smoking with a vaping machine or a vape, I guess is what we'll call it. And, you know, there always is a tax on the body when you take a puff of a vape. So I personally believe, to answer your question, that while in some cases it can be seen as hysteria, because it's not like an overwhelming amount of deaths, like it's not like 70,000 people are dying because of vaping.
And the ones that have been made the news and have been like sudden deaths, they've been using illegal compounds with it. So
yeah, for the ones that we know about, not only that, because there are a few that haven't been using illegal compounds.
And there's long term effects too. Like the government didn't know they didn't know for sure the effects of smoking until I'm going to throw this date out there, maybe until the late 70s or 80s. Mm. They knew a bit beforehand, but no, it wasn't solid proof.
Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure the government would have loved to have gotten out on cigarettes when it just came out, because the health risk, again, like you said, wasn't really appreciated at the time. But yeah, I think that's very, very interesting discussion. So we spoke a little bit about class actions today through the...
I agree, these are interesting topics, but now it's time for a commercial and music break. Afterwards, we will be interviewing Victoria and Marco of the Windsor Youth Intake Project. Stay tuned.
The Windsor Youth Center is a free drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in the Windsor-Essex area. The WYC assists people with many important things, such as replacing identification, housing applications, apartment searches, and resume writing, as well as providing meals, snacks, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East and is open Monday to Saturday from 5 p.m. until 10 p.m. For more information, visit their website at thewindsoryouthcenter.org or give them a call at 226-674-0006.
Advertise with CJAM 99.1 FM. We offer the most flexible and competitive rates for radio advertising in Windsor, Detroit. Our diverse programming can fit the needs of a range of organizations and businesses. Choose between daily rates for broad coverage or sponsor a show and target a specific audience. CJAM staff will work with you to craft your ad and choose the airtime that suits your needs. For more information, email statcjam@gmail.com, call 519-253-3000, extension 2525, or go to cjam.ca/advertise.
promise me forever that we live a life as one. We made a vow, we live a love so true. It seems that she has left me for such reasons unexplained. I need to find the truth. Let's see, what will I do? And it doesn't seem to matter, and it doesn't seem right. Crystal wheel has brought no fortune, still I cry alone at night. Don't you judge if I'm not composure, cause I'm lying every day. And she didn't leave a letter, she just up and ran away.
Hello, Windsor, Detroit. We are back with volunteers Victoria and Marco of the Windsor Youth Intake Project. Now, we're just going to go through a few questions and ask them about their law school experience, and then we'll lead into what they do at the Intake Project. So, how are you guys enjoying law school so far?
I mean, I'm having a really good time. I'm in third year now, so I've been here for a while. The Windsor community is great, and I'm looking forward to the rest of this year.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it as well. I'm a first-year student, so new to Windsor, but it's a great town. I love it, and the classes are great. The professors are wonderful. I'm really enjoying it.
That's good. So what would you say is your favorite classes so far?
For me, last year I took an elective class at Windsor. It was the wills and succession class, and I just found that very practical. I really liked the professor. I liked what I learned, and then, so I'm hoping maybe like sometime in my career I'll be able to draft wills for clients at some point. I just found it a really useful, practical course.
Definitely. There's a lot of people need wills.
I really like my contract law class. The professor's great. He's a practicing lawyer. So it's great to see how useful the things he's teaching us are every day as a lawyer. I never really considered how many things are contracts that I do a lot. So it's very eye-opening. I enjoy it.
So what are your plans when you're done law school?
Well, I'm graduating this spring, so after that, I'll do my articling here in Ontario, and then after that, I'm not sure exactly what I want to practice. Maybe I mentioned wills earlier, that I have an interest in that. Maybe family law, personal injury, kind of those personal-based areas of law I'm looking into.
I'm looking to get into corporate law. I'd like to work on Bay Street, and then long-term, I'd like to be a professor.
Nice. So what's important for people to understand is that many times when you graduate law, you may end up working in one field, but you can easily transfer to another. In fact, I've talked to a judge who initially only did commercial cases, but he transferred over to just being a criminal judge. So there's definitely a lot of flexibility. So it's good that you guys have an idea of what you want to do. So I'm going to lead into the project now. So what do you guys do at the Windsor Youth Intake Project?
So our project is we go every other week. We have a scheduled time. Ours happens to be Monday evenings for a few hours. We make ourselves available to the youth that attend the center. If they have any legal problems or questions, they can come to us, and we point them in the right direction of where they can maybe get some help.
It's very informal. We don't offer any legal advice. We definitely are an ear they can speak to. With our limited experience, we provide some information, some resources they can access as well.
So did you have any experience prior to working on this project? Did you have any experience? So wanted to know, like, how did you get selected for this opportunity?
I volunteered with kids in the past. I haven't specifically volunteered with homeless or at-risk youth, but I've done, like, literacy programs with kids before, so I knew I wanted to volunteer with a project that did work with youth in the community. I think it's a really good way to give back while we're here in Windsor, so that's kind of why I picked this project.
I've also done a lot of work in schools with students, so it's great to be with students again. The youth there are typically high school students, some are older, but it's great to work with young people. They're very energetic and they're enthusiastic about improving their situation, so it's great to be around that energy.
So I guess one other question I do have is, what has been the most interesting experience you've had working at the Windsor Youth Intake Project? So has there been an interesting thing that you're like, oh man, I didn't know about that? Or has there been something that's like, wow, this is really something I hope to bring with me in future practice?
I think we both noticed this last week. We were sitting at a table helping some people, and we looked outside the window, and there was a young girl, we think she was maybe 16 or 17. She had come into the center to get a blanket, and then she had gone back outside, and we were looking out the window at her, and she had taken the blanket, unfolded it, and was laying it down on the ground to go to sleep. And we talked about it on the car ride home, how impactful that moment was to see this young woman getting ready for bed, but her bed was outside, and that was her making her bed. And that stuck with us, and it really motivated us to continue our work. We dedicate a lot of time to preparing the resources we give to the young people there, so that, I think, really impacted us. It was very motivating and heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, like, you hear about these issues in communities, and you know they exist. You know that youth homelessness is an issue in Windsor and in other communities, but seeing it and being part, like, to being there and helping them is totally different, and it kind of opens your eyes to what it's actually like and motivates you to actually do something about it.
So what would you say is something that the average citizen or the average law student could do to assist in this issue? You know, not everyone is a part of the Windsor Youth Intake Project, but how can they bring it into their personal practice, or how can the listener bring it into their daily life, how they can help the Windsor youth today?
I mean, I know the center receives a lot of donations, whether it's food donations, whether it's hygiene products, canned goods. They're always looking for donations, so that's something that any average citizen can do, donate to the center. I think a big part of it is just, like, becoming aware of what they need, what the needs are in the community. So they need donations, they need financial support, they need volunteers like us from different like career industries to come and help, whether it's like resume-based, helping them make resumes to get jobs, or what we do, provide legal information. Just kind of getting involved from, like, all different areas in different ways, I think, is really helpful.
Yes, and you might not know, but a lot of the youth that go to the Windsor Youth Center might be your classmates, might be your friends. So if you have, you know, any sort of suspicion or any sort of inkling that somebody might need some help, just reach out to a friend, right? You don't necessarily have to get to the youth center. If you can, that's great. But if you know somebody who needs help and they're young and you have any sort of legal resources you can provide them, help them out.
Yeah, I think it's also important to know that it could be that anyone could really find themselves in that situation due to a medical emergency, losing a job, or a death of someone in their family, whether it be a loved one or someone who really helps them throughout our lives. So it's important that we have these services available for them too. So what would you guys say is the best part of working for this project?
I mean, I really throughout my volunteering time with Pro Bono, I've volunteered every year. I've looked for projects that really help me get involved in the community. I mean, I'm only in Windsor for a short time during law school before I go back home. So I'm always looking for ways to get involved. So I think it's really rewarding to be able to interact with the community that has, like, welcomed us here to live in Windsor for a few years while we're in law school.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's also great to work with Victoria. She's a third-year law student, so it's a great role model for me to see what it looks like. And Victoria's great at really connecting with people, and I have a really tough time with that. So that's great. So it's nice to see that.
Yeah, that's good that you guys are getting a lot out of it while also giving giving back to our community as well.
That's awesome. So one other question that we do have is, and this may be something a little too difficult, I hope not. How has the provincial cuts affected the project? Is that something that you feel like you can speak to or
perfect? Yeah, so on our first orientation day when we went to the center, they told us that previously the center had been open, I think it was 7 days a week.
Definitely on Saturdays.
Yeah, and now there's one day that they had to close, so they can't be open every day. Mm-hmm. And that's simply because of budget cuts. So on those days, the youth, every evening the center provides a hot meal for youth in the community. So on those days, like, they wouldn't be able to have that. They'd have to find other resources elsewhere, which may not be available.
Even with the amount of food that they can provide and the actual things that they are able to give the youth that are there, with the cuts, they can't give as much. They have to ration more carefully. So, for example, if somebody before these cuts was able to get like a package of food every couple of days, now it might be once a week. And depending on how often they go, they might have to cut it back as well.
Can you guys go into more of your experience of working with the Youth Intake Project? Like, is there anything that pops up in your mind?
We can give you like an overview of like step by step how the project kind of works. So we go, as we mentioned, every other week to the youth center on like a set date and time so that the youth hopefully know when we're coming, and then they'll know we'll be back in 2 weeks if they have any more questions. So we try to keep that consistent. And then we're there, we make ourselves available just like in a super casual setting to let them know that we're there to listen to any problems in the community that they're having. With their permission, we'll record the information. Sometimes they'd prefer if we didn't record any information, which is totally fine. It's their decision. And that way we can take it back. We can do some research. We can draft a quick memo and send it to our supervising lawyer to get more advice on what the best direction to point them in with the specific issue they're having is. And then the goal is that we would be able to bring that back next time we're at the center there, and then have if the youth is at the center also, then we could meet with them again and kind of provide them the information that we've come up with and help guide them in the right direction.
A lot of the things we typically deal with are residential stuff in terms of like housing and apartments, contracts they have with their tenants. We also deal a lot with employment issues. So if a youth is working and they feel like their employee isn't paying them the right amount, they might be taking advantage of them because the employer might think that this youth who they see as visibly homeless might not be aware of how much they should be paying, what the minimum wage is, things like that. We're able to help them with their contracts and make sure that everything's okay, and we can look it over with them and guide them to the next steps in terms of making sure that they're paid the right amount.
There's so many issues that these vulnerable youth face. What do you think are some misconceptions or notions that people have going into a project like this, or dealing with a population like this?
Do you remember, Victoria? I think there was on our first time there. It was our first time dealing with somebody, and I didn't expect them. Well, when you have an idea of what homeless people look like, you expect maybe somebody very like visibly dirty and maybe not so well spoken, and that's obviously a problem with the way society teaches us to view homeless people, right? That's its own problem. But when we saw some of the youth come in and we realized that, you know, they could be my classmate right beside me in any one of my classes, they could be my friend, it really opened our eyes to how pervasive this issue is and how much more aware we have to be in terms of helping these people. You know, the stereotypes, yeah, I mean, sure, some of them might be true, but a lot of them aren't, and you have to be very aware of that and open-minded.
Yeah, I mean, I would totally agree with what Marco just said. It could be your classmates that are using the resources that places like the Windsor Youth Center has to offer. You just never know. So yeah. I think it's important to break down those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when I worked for the ID project, the first client we ever had was definitely defied all the stereotypes that a poor person or a homeless person would have. They were very well spoken, and they seemed to have their life together, except that they were for a reason that we didn't know, they were homeless. So we were able to walk them through the process quite easily and get them identification they needed, and hopefully they got their life back on track, which is hopefully what your clients can do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hope. Yeah.
One question I do have also, I'm wondering, do you feel like the youth of today know their rights? Is that something that's taught well enough, in your opinion, based off of your experiences at the Youth Intake Project? And do you feel like you're still learning your rights as you enter law school, you know, starting out? You know, because the interesting thing about the law is that it's something that has to be taught, right? So is there more of an onus on society to instill more positive rights for youth? Or is it something that, you know, there's more of a mass education that needs to happen, in your opinion? And I know that feels expansive, but it's not as expansive as it sounds.
I mean, I think that touches on the big access to justice problem that we're currently facing and have been for some time. A combination of budget cuts and just like the lack of resources for everyday people to learn the law. I mean, we're in law school for 3 years and we still don't, that's not enough time to learn everything. So how can you expect the average citizen to be able to learn everything while they have their own day job? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, a lot of the questions we've had, a few questions just about like court processes in general, like what's going to happen at court? Is there going to be someone there to help me? Like, where do I go? I got these papers in the mail. What do I do? And I think that's kind of like the starting point when people start to get involved with the law. Is I think it's a good opportunity to be able to teach them, like, it has like the date and time that you have to go. If it's a criminal matter, duty counsel would probably be available to you. So maybe go a little early and try to speak with them for some advice, because they'd actually be lawyers and be able to provide legal advice. So mm-hmm. things like that, that might come easy to law students, that we would know those kinds of things after law school that everyday citizens might not.
And we're especially sympathetic to younger people because, you know, as somebody who comes from, you know, a privileged family, I wouldn't have to deal with these issues, these things these kids are dealing with, right? I mean, I couldn't possibly imagine having to, you know, pick a court date and get these resources. And so these are things I don't think about. So for them not to know, I sympathize with that, because, I mean, how would they, right? I mean, why should they? And it's part of the reason why lawyers exist, right? We're here to help with that. So absolutely, there can definitely be more education, definitely in schools. Young people, especially when they're starting to look for work, they should definitely have more knowledge about what constitutes a safe workplace, what their rights as workers are, how much they should be getting paid, basic stuff like that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, they should be young and enjoy life, right? So, you know, I hope also at the same time that they don't have to obsess about knowing the law, you know, completely through and through, right, that they can come find people like us to help them.
I think that's really important, and I think those are awesome answers. One other question that I had, I guess because I worked at Pro Bono Law Help Ontario in downtown Toronto this past summer, and what I've noticed is that the average citizen, when they come in and they're facing a legal issue, they're at their worst. You know, you got to be a life coach for
That's
15
so true,
minutes
yeah.
before you find out the legal issue in the next five. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, how much of a balance is being there for people at their worst versus actually giving legal advice? And is that something that's more elevated when you're dealing with youth, especially youth with different issues, some of them with mental health issues? Like, how do you mitigate those experiences?
Mm-hmm. I think it definitely is a balance. A big part of it is, at the beginning, I find it really helps to just listen. A lot of times, people going through really hard times are just looking for someone to talk to about it. And another aspect of that is that people don't know when they have a legal issue. They just know they have an issue. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even in our law exams, one of the hardest things is to issue spot.
Oh my
and
gosh.
So with legal training, it's still difficult. So people...
No, it's not. It's not.
You'll get through this.
Yeah. Slowly but surely, we'll make it. But yeah, so if people don't know it's a legal issue, they just know they're having an issue. They might not know important things to tell you or like what is actually relevant to the law. They might be fixating on something that's not really, there's not a legal remedy for it, but there is for other things. So I think it's really important to just kind of like listen, let them tell you what's going on, ask questions to have them open up more and build that trust connection, because if they don't trust
and
you, then you're
so
not
good
gonna...
at that. Victoria's so good at that.
So is Marco.
No, I'm okay. Victoria's really good at that. She makes everybody feel so comfortable. And I think what you said is right. That first 15 minutes, that's such a great, you know, way to see it. I have to always remind myself that these are real people and that when they're done talking to us, you know, they got to go outside and live their life. And that's so hard, and I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. For me, this is volunteer work, and a lot of it is theoretical. I don't actually have to go and defend these people. I don't actually have to, you know, prepare, you know, legal advice for these people. So, yeah, that's such a great point. Those 15 minutes, it's a lot. It's at the time, it's can be emotionally very tough, but it's also very rewarding when you're done.
And I mean, especially for youth that are homeless or at risk, a lot of them don't have families to go home to. I mean, like, I know for me personally, I can talk to my family about anything that I'm frustrated about, but a lot of the youth that we come across, that's it. So it's really their first opportunity to get support. So if we're able to provide both kind of like emotional support by listening and the legal advice to kind of help, or sorry, legal information. We're not allowed to give legal advice, but legal information to kind of get them started to solve some of the problems that they're facing, I think that's really important.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking in the car after we had seen that young girl set up her bed outside. We were saying how we get to go now to our beds, like our beds with a mattress and like actual sheets and inside a room. And so that stuck with us. So it really motivated us to take this seriously, and that time we have with them is only a few hours, but we try and see as many people as possible. We encourage them to come up to us, and we go home and we do our research and we bring it back to them.
I think that's really important. I think that's really, really important. I think one scenario I'll give out, and I want to hear a scenario that's of intrigue to you. I was this summer when I was at Pro Bono, we had a lady, and this is why I was saying 15 minutes of life story and then 5 minutes of legal advice. She came in, and her sister was suing her for a property they purchased together.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was about 20 years ago, and the loan that was taken out was about $50,000, and the sister paid off the loan, but then sued her for the interest plus the remainder. So it was about $60,000, $70,000 lawsuit.
Wow.
And she came in, very distressed, older woman. And when I looked, I was like, okay, did you draft a statement of defense? Did you do any of that? And she came in and showed me her statement of defense. It was written in cursive on paper. And when I read her statement of defense, it was like, I can't believe my sister is doing this to me. This hurt me. But when I looked at her sister's notice motion that she brought forward, I was shocked when it was a major firm that was representing her sister.
Wow.
But her sister was a self-represented litigant, the other sister that came into pro bono. And the reason why I'm saying this story, which is of interest, is that this kind of creates the disparity of how the law is really a tool of how much money you have opposed to how much justice you can receive based off of your experience. So then my question, I guess, would be the final question that we can wrap up with is, how can you try your best to take away your experiences here with the Windsor Youth Intake Project and bring it to any kind of practice that you plan doing going forward?
I mean, after volunteering with this project and in years past with other pro bono projects, I mean, I think I've really learned the value of helping the self-represented litigants. That's a part of the access to justice problem. And I think throughout my career now, as after I graduate, it's something that I'll really have in the forefront of my mind to do pro bono work throughout my career and really engage with charities and organizations that are providing for the, even just the homeless and at risk in our local communities, because it is, we're all part of the same community. I think it's our responsibility to give back where we can, and everyone work together.
And that's what's so great about this. I mean, and we speak about this all the time, I can still see that young girl with her blanket setting up her bed outside. Like, I can see the blanket. I know what color it is. I know what jacket she was wearing. I remember it all so well. So I take that image with me. I want to get into corporate law. And you know, even if I wanted to forget about it, I just can't, because it sticks with you. So that's what I think is so great about pro bono, is that, you know, the emotional connection you make, it has a lasting impression. And because I still see her, I can't imagine not doing more pro bono work in the future as a corporate lawyer. I think any field of law you get into, you can find time to help people, right? I mean, you're talking about the sisters, you know, maybe as a corporate lawyer, I could help that other sister, right? I mean, why not?
It's also a requirement, too. I believe we have to do around 40 hours, but then there's, of course, a lot of lawyers do extra as well. So, so it's definitely the law society definitely it is aware of the need for these types of services as well. So, is there anything else we want to bring up today?
I think we've kind of covered it.
Thank you for having us.
No problem. Thank you very much for coming. We really enjoyed having you guys on. It was a very enlightening conversation. Thank you very much to Victoria and Marco for coming on and telling us about the Windsor Youth Intake Project. This is a reminder to our listeners that you can listen to CGM 99.1 anywhere, either in your radio, or you can go onto our website at www.cgm.ca.gov to catch previously recorded shows and the next show, which will be airing next week on November 22nd. See the man who was dead for you, me, you, giving all the peace of life for your wife. Everybody wanna know how it feels. Everybody wanna see what it's like. My baby wanna be a queen. Well, alright, we all deserve to find the peace in this life. So
say for you mean? I say it's gonna put some love in your life. Don't you really wanna know how it feels? Everybody wanna see what it's like, but even wanna be inside, it ain't lies. We all know there's better things in this life.
Hey Jammers, my name is Taya and I'm a third year student at the University of Windsor and a CJAM volunteer. I started volunteering at CJAM during my first semester of university. Since then, I've written and recorded PSAs and ads for CJAM, hosted live and pre-recorded music programs, and participated in our pledge drive each year. Now, I'm currently on the board of directors and attend board meetings and get to work with other CJAM volunteers to make decisions that are best for the station. I now have a whole new set of skills to put on my resume and some experience. CJAM offers a space for students to learn new skills and gain experiences outside of the classroom. Support CJAM today.
Save 15.